Right. This is obviously a kind of short version of this paper. The longer version is on academia.edu, and that has I don't discuss any of the literary text in this talk. This is all kind of theoretical and scientific framework. The texts that I discuss in the longer version are Call of the Wild, a brilliant Canadian short story called As Birds Bring Forth the Sun, and an amazing contemporary novel called Dog Boy by Ava Hornung that I recommend very strongly. And I'd really like to take the opportunity to thank Erica both for accepting my paper and coming here, but also I think for organising a conference of just astounding papers, one after the other. Just every single one has been so fascinating to me. Erica did me the honour or the good service some years ago, pointing out that the chapter on animals in my book, Eco-Criticism, was very interesting but really kind of beside the point in terms of animal studies.
I didn't quite say that.
No, I think what she said precisely was, that's not what I do, which I think is quite a nice way of putting it. And when I had the opportunity to do a second edition for Routledge, I went back to it and I realised that she was completely right, and that my presentation of animal studies had been completely wrong. And so in the second edition, that's the only bit that has been completely rewritten practically from scratch. So I'd be very interested to get kind of more feedback on that and see kind of how it is as an introduction to the field. This is about ferality tales, but it's about specifically about dogs, I should say. Two forms of progress are often confused with one another, scientific and moral. Both are real, I would argue, but where scientific progress is cumulative, and apocalypse apart, irreversible, moral advances have to be entrenched in political constitutions if they're not to be undone by ideological changes. The reason for the fragility of moral progress is that the human animals supposedly running the show are as fallible and as contradictory as they've ever been, which imposes important limits on our moral responses. As psychologist Daniel Gilbert has argued in an article in the LA Times memorably titled, If Only Gay Sex Caused Global Warming. He writes, although all human societies have moral rules about food and sex, none has a moral rule about atmospheric chemistry. And so we are outraged about every breach of protocol except Kyoto. Yes, global warming is bad, but it doesn't make us feel nauseated or angry or disgraced, and thus we don't feel compelled to rail against it as we do against other momentous threats to our species, such as flag burning. The fact is that if climate change were caused by gay sex or by the practice of eating kittens, millions of protesters would be massing in the streets. So whereas scientific knowledge begets more knowledge so long as the global research base exists and continues to communicate, moral wisdom has to be relearned painfully and unreliably by every generation afresh. Does art belong with science or with morality? Art changes, perhaps even develops, but does not progress. If Ian McEwan's Atonement is a better novel than Crime and Punishment, it's not because it's more recent. Partly this is because novels and poems are singular in the sense articulated by Derek Attridge in an astonishing book called The Poetics of Singularity. They are non-commensurable and, unlike a valid scientific experiment, unrepeatable. Partly it's because they respond as avidly to the relative stability of human nature as to technological and even broader historical changes. Even so, I want to argue that literature and literary criticism can contribute to scientific progress, provided we conceive of it more generously than we have heretofore. The potential for such interdisciplinary progress is most obvious in eco-criticism and animal studies. According to biologist E.O. Wilson, the greatest enterprise of the mind has always been and always will be the attempted linkage of the sciences and the humanities, a project he calls consilience. It's an immense and progressive ambition for research across the academic disciplines, yet his version of it insists on locating physics at the head of a rigid hierarchy of coordinated scientific explanation. Only if they submit to the authority of the natural sciences will the humanities be permitted to contribute to human and biospheric welfare and the advancement of knowledge. Ferality Tales, then, is inspired by Wilson's hopes, but seeks to show that the various epistemic frameworks of the disciplines can and should collaborate successfully on more or less equal terms. As Stephen Rose says, our world maybe is, I would claim, an ontological unity, but to understand it, we need the epistemological diversity that different levels of explanation afford. Virality, I would say, is an ideal test case for three reasons. It's a key point of dispute between environmental ethics and animal rights. It's a subject on which scientific perspectives have changed quite dramatically in recent years. And third, it has inspired some really superb fictions in the course of the 20th and 21st centuries. And they themselves show transformations in ideas of ferality, though I won't have time to talk about that. We'll therefore be locating ferality by, I use the metaphor for mapping, of triangulating from animal studies and eco-criticism, ethology and evolutionary ecology, and literary fiction, using the insights and perhaps lacunae of each to produce a multifaceted interdisciplinary projection of this concept. So first, ferality between animal studies and eco-criticism. Linnaeus's epochal taxonomy Systema Naturae, 1735, boldly classified humans among the human-like apes, causing both theological and scientific dismay. Writing to a colleague, Linnaeus responded, "It is unacceptable because man has been categorized amongst the anthropomorpha, but man knows himself." It seems indeed that self-knowledge is what defines this species, if anything does. Pursuing this strange basis for categorization, Giorgio Agamben comments that Linnaeus does not record, as he does with other species, any specific identifying characteristic next to the generic name homo, only the old philosophical adage, nosce te ipsum, know thyself. It is worth reflecting on this taxonomic anomaly, which assigns not a given, but rather an imperative, as a specific difference. But if sapiens alludes not descriptively to the wisdom of our kind, and after all, how could it, but to the faculty required to recognize ourselves at all, Homo sapiens, argues Agamben, is neither a clearly defined species nor a substance. It is rather a machine or device for producing the recognition of the human. Located at or even as the species boundary is, Agamben says, the feral man, which Linnaeus categorizes as a biological variant of our species, Homo ferus. To Agamben, the enfants sauvages, who appear more and more often on the edges of the villages of Europe, are the messengers of man's inhumanity, the witnesses to his fragile identity and lack of a face of his own. Although the feral man is recognized as human, he or it, quote, seems to belie the characteristics of the most noble of the primates, point for point. It is tetrapus, walks on all fours, mutus, without language, and hirsutus, covered with hair. Just on the other side of that imaginary boundary is the animal, through whose difference and inferiority Homo sapiens habitually defines himself, as if gazing in a kind of weird anti-mirror. And if the domestic animal is the one who seems to affirm our sovereignty and power most unambiguously, perhaps the feral animal is the one that, like the feral man, refuses to face us, and in doing so, frustrates our preening self-identification. The question of feral animals is particularly pointed in Australia, which is plagued by feral and invasive exotic species, but which was also the birthplace of modern animal rights. Passions run high when environmentalists and animal rights advocates discuss feral animals. In the early work of land ethic proponent J. Baird Callicott, domestication seems to have an almost mystical power to denature animals. This links up with lots of other papers, I think. He says, domestic animals are creations of man. They are living artifacts, but artifacts nonetheless. There is something profoundly incoherent in the complaint of some animal liberationists that the natural behaviour of chickens and male calves is cruelly frustrated on factory farms. It would make almost as much sense to speak of the natural behaviour of tables and chairs. Because domestic animals have been, he says, bred to docility, tractability, stupidity and dependency, it is literally meaningless to suggest that they be liberated. It is no doubt significant that he does not include dogs in his list of denatured animals, as his list of demeaning traits would not comfortably encompass Rottweilers, docile, Jack Russell Terriers, tractable, and Border Collies, stupid. Released feral animals, though, claims Callicott, reveal the truth of the situation, the underlying truth. They either die, confirming their enfeebled vulnerability, or like feral mustangs, they survive, he says, begins to recover some of their remote, wild, ancestral genetic traits and become smaller, leaner, heartier, and smarter versions of their former selves. it's not hard to see why Callicott's uncompromising land ethic, which subordinates all individual rights, human and animal, to the supra-organismic interests he vests in the ecosystem, was chastised by Tom Regan as environmental fascism. On the other hand, Callicott's ire is understandable given the immense destructive capability of feral animals, which is well known to environmentalists and conservation biologists. Perhaps the worst example is the rabbit introduced into Australia as a game animal by a farmer in 1859. Before the introduction of myxomatosis, Australian rabbit populations were as high as 10 billion, leading to profound ecological changes in the outback. Feral cats have been held responsible for the extinction of several insular species of birds and are considered another imported scourge of Australia's native wildlife, along with feral camels and horses or brumbies. Dogs have not had such a bad press, although Robert Whittaker, biogeographer, noticed that domestic dogs can also be devastating, and feral populations have been responsible for the local extinction of land iguanas on the Galapagos. Yet the rights of Australian ferals have been defended by Peter Singer, while Philip Armstrong has claimed that, quote, the history of modernity shows the attempt to eradicate, regulate, commodify, or otherwise manipulate wildness tends to result in ferity, the return of wildness or an escape back to it or its redirection into unexpected modes. This is the application of a kind of deconstructive logic to feralization. I would argue, though, that if the turn of the repressed is bad psychology, the return of the wild is even worse ecology, because usually when industrial modernity decides to eradicate wildness, it simply succeeds. Adrian Franklin's outrageously tangentious book, Animal Nation, goes further, accusing environmentalists of being motivated more by nationalism and racism than ecology. He says, in the same way that ecology matches the right organisms to a given ecosystem, nationalism matches the right people to the right territory. The contrast between environmental and animal rights approaches to ferality do seem to be kind of intractable on the surface, but are actually resolved by dialogue in practice quite frequently. But the construction of feral animals variously as denatured artifacts, invasive aliens, or on the other hand, subversive agents or innocent victims of eco-nationalism, I think these artifacts, aliens, agents, victims represents a potent dichotomy in the representational politics of animals. And as we will see in the case of dogs, both positions are in need of revision. Ferality between ethology and evolutionary ecology. Just as human depends, as we have seen, on animal for its meaning, feral depends on domestic and wild. Until the 1980s, a view prevailed, both in popular and scientific accounts of canine domestication, that S.K. Robish has dubbed the campfire myth in a brilliant book on wolves, in which the ancestors of modern dogs were irresistibly attracted to the warmth and smell of roasting meat of cavemen's fires and were tamed first by familiarity and later by deliberate selection. How flattering a story it is to us is evident from Jack London's novel White Fang, which tells the story of a wolf cub that accepts domestication, effectively recapitulating speculative phylogeny as fictional ontogeny. White Fang's half-wolf, half-dog mother, Quiche, accepts the domination of man as a sort of spiritual revelation, but one more firmly grounded in the facts of life. This is a quote. No effort of faith, writes London, is necessary to believe in such a god. This is us lot, we're the gods. No effort of will can possibly induce disbelief in such a god. There is no getting away from it. There it stands, on its two hind legs, club in hand, immensely potential, passionate and wrathful and loving. God and mystery and power, wrapped up and around by flesh that bleeds when it is torn and that is good to eat like any flesh. London promotes us to a peculiar kind of divine condition, weak, edible creatures made by evolution to transcend and ultimately direct evolution. It's a kind of incarnation. He certainly intended the privileged rank of the dog as man's lieutenant to remain undemeaned. But given the tool-centered construction of prehistory that prevailed in 20th century culture, ages of stone and bronze and iron, it was only a couple of short hops from good soldier to fine instrument, and thence to Callicott's stupid artifact. Donna Haraway passes scathing judgment on such narratives. Humanist technophiliac, she writes, depict domestication as the paradigmatic act of masculine single-parent self-birthing, whereby man makes himself repetitively as he invents, brackets, creates his tools. Man took the free wolf and made the servant dog, and so made civilization possible. The campfire myth is anthropocentric twice over. Once because it assumes that domestication is something, good or bad, we did to wolves, and again because it neglects the examples of domestication that do not involve humans at all. Regarding humans' domestication of plants, for instance, Michael Pollan counterintuitively sets out in The Botany of Desire to understand the qualities in plants. He talks about marijuana, tulips, apples and potatoes, that, as it were, seduced us, attracted humans more or less unconsciously to domesticate them. He writes, "We automatically think of domestication as something we do to other species, but it makes just as much sense to think of it as something certain plants and animals have done to us, a clever evolutionary strategy for advancing their own interests. Given that there are roughly 100,000 to 200,000 wolves in the world, and around 500 million dogs, the evolutionary of domestication, the gamble of domestication, seems to have paid off for the ancestors of dogs. The new scientific consensus is, according to Adam Miclosi, that the natural environment of the dog is that ecological niche which has been created by humans. And that it was the Paleolithic midden, not the fireside, that was most likely to have been the primal scene of domestication. More remarkably, the scientific evidence suggests that not only have convergent processes made dogs fit for the anthropogenic environment, but also that dog and human behaviour actually share some important features. This is extraordinary new evidence, mostly from Miclosi's lab, that suggests that anthropomorphism is an evolutionary and not just a representational or a psychological process. We've made them more like us. Like children, but unlike chimpanzees and socialised wolves, dogs pay careful attention to the gaze and gestures of adult humans and respond to their referential aspects. They take the gaze as ostensive, as philosophers would say. Perhaps most endearingly, Miclosi found that whereas socialised wolves carried on worrying indefinitely at a frustrating puzzle task, after a few attempts, he writes, most dogs stopped trying and looked at their owner who was standing behind them. Conversely, David Paxton purports to show that so intimate has dog-human coevolution been that our brains have changed so as to enhance our complementary capacities. In short, we do some of their thinking for them while they do almost all of our smelling for us. While together, he says, we and dogs make up a composite animal that has the ability to speak. Although sceptical of Paxton's claims, Haraway prefers what she calls such remodeled versions of evolution that give dogs and other species the first moves in domestication and then choreograph an unending dance of distributed and heterogeneous agencies. In evolutionary terms, and until vets and pet insurance made breeding sick animals viable, domestication of dogs is not subjugation, but rather a specialised form of symbiosis. Like all intimate relationships, and in contrast to the fuzzy feel-good notion of symbiosis prevalent in popular ecology, domestication includes the potential, of course, for anguish, cruelty, and incomprehension on both sides, as well as joy, love, and mutual benefits. We have eaten dogs at times, and they have eaten us. But as the Aboriginal saying has it, it is dogs that make us human. Crucially, for our purposes, Miclosi insists that adult socialized offspring from feral dogs adult socialized offspring from feral dogs should be indistinguishable from dogs living in human families. Note that in this sense, feralization is the opposite process to socialization and not domestication, which was often implied in earlier writings. In the literature of ferality, then, we can expect to encounter two major forms in which it is recognized. First, and this is what you find in Jack London, certainly, and in later literature, ferality is an existential condition midway between more or less reified notions of domesticity and wildness, reflecting the old anthropocentric consensus. And secondly, the representation of ferality as a developmental vicissitude affecting or befalling our most intimate symbiont. In that sense, we ought to expect that there is no such thing as a wild dog. The alternatives are merely socialized, unsocialized, domestic, and feral. Anthropomorphism, it turns out, is less of a problem than lupomorphism, in these ferality tales. The dog seems inherently and surprisingly resistant to what Steve Baker has called Disneyfication, but is at considerable risk of departing domesticity only to arrive at ferality as effectively a wolf. Turns out that feral dogs don't behave in packs as pack animals, so they don't revert to a wolf-like social existence. That option seems not to be available to them. As we have seen, anthropomorphic representations are actually better supported on scientific grounds than lupomorphic ones. Conclusion. Canis familiaris, what used to be in that space was all the literary stuff. Canis familiaris is a designation about as odd as Homo sapiens. According to the biological species concept, which is based on the ability to interbreed, Canis familiaris is a subspecies of Canis lupus, while some scientists have argued that we are really just the third chimpanzee, genus Pongo. Presiding alone over the genus Homo is, on this view, justifiable only on theological, not taxonomic grounds. As part of our family, our evolutionary familiar and first domesticate, the dog has been promoted by Pongo sapiens from Canis lupus subspecies familiaris, perhaps in recognition of their role in our self-recognition. We have, as it were, ennobled each other. Yet, as James Serple pointed out, though, our good lieutenant remains liminal. To be loved by a paragon is one thing. To be adored by a creature that eats shit, sniffs genitals and bites people is quite another. In symbolic terms, the dog exists precariously in the no man's land between human and non-human worlds. If the dog lies on the boundary between human and animal, at once imaginary and effective as it is, the feral dog is the border's border. It possesses the agency idealized by Armstrong as a generalized ferity, but is as likely to direct it back towards enhanced intimacy as subversion. Environmentalist generalizations about ferality as inherently a kind of biological pollution, worse even than chemicals or radiation because self-sustaining, are belied by studies of dog populations in Italy that show they would vanish without human waste to feed on and abandoned dogs to replenish their numbers. Despite environmentalist contempt, the dog's domesticity is not demeaning or denaturing. Its seeming wildness is provisional, not existential. Feral dogs are only one socialized generation from return from the co-evolutionary fold. At the same time, though, in the most sophisticated of ferality tales, the hardship and scandal of ferality for both its human and canine victims recasts the symbiosis of dogs and people, not as a biopolitical oppression, but as the most ancient and demanding of moral responsibilities for both parties. Thank you.